Good evening, everybody. You're watching School Psych Podcast. Thank you for hanging out with us. We're running a little bit late, so I really appreciate you guys hanging out and sticking with us and seeing it through. Really excited about our guest tonight, a little bit starstruck. Before we get going, first off, my name is Rachel. I'm a school psychologist working in the state of Maryland. But I also wanted to mention that we have kind of a little side project going on right now. That's posted to our page. We're using a Google form to acquire some information from you guys about working conditions for school psychologists. So it's just a quick Google form that asks about, you know, where you live, and you can just specify the state if you want to remain a little bit more anonymous. You can list your district. You can tell us a little bit of a review, salary, you know, basic stuff. So, and then you can view everyone else's responses, which I think is super helpful for those of us that are moving around. So check out on the Facebook page. That Google form, which also has the link to the responses that you can sort according to role and salary and state and things like that. So that's just another thing that we've got going on. But anyways, I'm going to turn it over to Rebecca now. Rebecca?
Hi, everybody. I'm Rebecca. I'm a school psychologist working in the state of Connecticut. I want to remind you a little bit about all the ways we would love for you to participate tonight. If you are watching this video live, please feel free to sign in to YouTube and comment right in the live chat box alongside your video screen. You can also comment on either of the Facebook pages, School Psych, Your School Psychologist, or School Psych Podcast page, and you can post your comments anywhere you'd like. You can post right under the last post of the page, which was for this podcast event, or you can post privately in messages, or anywhere, really. I'll be looking for those notifications on either page and on Twitter using the hashtag PsychedPodcast. Looking forward to hearing your questions and thoughts and connections. And here is Anna.
Hi, guys. I'm Anna. I'm a school psych in New York State. I'd like to introduce our host, or our guest today, Dr. Kevin McGrew. He is the director of the Institute for Applied Psychometrics, IAP, and visiting lecturer in educational psychology, school psychology program at the University of Minnesota. He received his BA in psychology, 1974, and MS in school psychology, 1975, from Moorhead State University, Moorhead, Minnesota. He received his doctorate in educational psychology at the University of Minnesota, 1989. McGrew has 12 years of experience practicing as a school psychologist in the state of Iowa and Minnesota. He subsequently was a professor of applied psychology and educational psychology at St. Cloud State University in St. Cloud, Minnesota. He served as the research director for the Woodcock Muniz Foundation from 2005 to 2014. He also served as the associate director for Measurement Learning Consultations, MLC, from 2008 to 2014. So he's currently serving as an intelligence theory and testing consultant to two major international test development projects. He serves as in the capacity 2014 to president of the Dharma Bermaka Foundation of the University in Indonesian. I'm sorry, I'm going to skip that a little bit.
Cognitive assessment.
Thank you. I'm sorry. And so he's really got a lot going on. Dr. McGrew, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's great to be here. Sorry for the technical problems.
You're good. We're so happy that you're here. We're just like kind of a little bit giddy. So,
do I have to kind of compress things now, or can we do we?
I'm able to stay a little bit later for sure. Okay. So if you have the time and are willing to give it, I'm willing to go beyond 9. I can't speak to my co-host here, but.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna skip some slides, and I had to in at the last minute. I was gonna get rid of those.
Okay, sounds good.
So
you've got a presentation for us, and
okay,
you are one of the people behind the Woodcock Johnson, right?
What I'm gonna do is do a brief presentation, and then I'd like to have more time for discussion and questions. So I'm gonna go really fast. This is a presentation that Joel Schneider and I did at NASP this last year. A couple months ago, it was a mini skill session. So it's 2 hours of material. I'm going to try doing 30 minutes. So I'm going to talk fast. The slides are available. There'll be some slides in here that aren't in the PDF, but that's just the way it is. What I'm going to do is just get started here. First, make sure I got the technology working correctly. Mm-hmm. Am I live?
Yep. I see your first page. Yep.
Okay. What this is basically I'm summarizing And if you can't see anything, let me know. What Joel Schneider and I did, and it's basically our update of our CHC chapter in Don Flanagan's upcoming book, The Contemporary Intellectual Assessment, kind of the state of the art of what CHC is all about. And I'm skipping these slides. You want me to come back to them? They're really cool. But we don't have time for those. In fact, I'm going to really... This is stuff I put in at the last minute and to give a big picture context. And I'm going to skip those. So are you seeing what is intelligence?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, this is the beginning of Joel's and my presentation. You know, is it one thing or many things? Actually, it's one thing and many things. And before I get going too far, there's a big debate in academic school psychology right now. A bunch of people are arguing about which factor model is correct in representing intelligence tests. And it's just a, you know, tis so, tis not. It's a huge debate. And a lot of information is coming out in school psychologists about don't do this with your IQ tests or don't do this. You can't do this. You should do this. And it's basically these two different types of statistical models, which I'm actually getting really kind of frustrated with, because what they're trying to do is represent this, you know, that the brain is a dynamic interaction of different brain networks. So all these models are wrong. You know, they're useful heuristics to help understand what tests are measuring, but they really don't explain the structure and what's going on with human intelligence. So I don't want to get into any of those kind of debates today. I'm working on a response to all that kind of stuff because I'm getting kind of frustrated with the discussions, which seem to be all about statistics. Okay, so this is kind of a nice, these are Joel Schneider's slides. He's the Van Gogh of PowerPoint. This is a very nice structural model of intelligence. G at the top, the CHC abilities, narrow abilities, and tests. It's very symmetrical. It's neat and tidy, and it's, you know, kind of represents the Horn-Cattell model. But John Horn himself says structural theory doesn't describe natural phenomenon well, because natural phenomenon don't fit into nice equation systems. To understand human intelligence, so you got to look at things in terms of all these different kind of nonlinear things that are going on, like that model I showed of the brain. It's not just a series of linear equations, which is what kind of bothers me about a lot of academic school psychologies. My factor model is better than your factor model right now. And this is what Joel said, presents, is that the weird and wild reality is that human capabilities are really more funky and more nonlinear. And to help understand intelligence, we need to look at functional theories, which is where Joel and I are spending most of our time. And we don't really have a lot of interest in debating my model's better than your model. We want to go farther, and I'll be getting into that. And what Joel basically says, these are his beautiful slides. Are they showing up well? Are you guys there?
Yep, they look really good. I'm very much impressed.
Well, they're not mine. They're Joel's. This is what you think you see in when you read chapters and stuff in technical manuals, nice little structural models of what the tests measure in CHC. What really is going on is the weird and wild reality underneath. There's a lot of stuff going on under the hood that just is very doesn't fit into those nice models that well. And in fact, Joel and I are iterating towards stuff like this, where we are integrating a causal relationship between processing speed, working memory, which causes fluid reasoning. And it's actually, there should be arrows between the CHC abilities and integrated with interests and personality characteristics to really understand what's going on with humans. But for now, the CHC, what I'm going to talk about, and I'll get back to the dynamic models later, is the CHC model is really a taxonomy. And this is my presentation. It's a periodic table of human cognitive elements. It's the new CHC model organized like a periodic table. That's what we're updating in our chapter. Basically, here's the static model of CHC. What's changed since the last iteration of it? And I'm going to give you a quick summary. I'm skipping fluid intelligence and crystallized. There's some changes there, but they're very more cosmetic and such. But in terms of, if you're a practicing school psychologist and looking at, well, what's changed with the taxonomy? I use cross-battery assessment, or I use Woodcock-Johnson, and the authors say it measures working memory or attentional control or memory span. Well, the GWM taxonomy is now changing in the newest version of CHC. And we have auditory short-term storage. It's coded WA, and we explain in the book where these codes come from. It's keeping the historical tradition of where this stuff came from, originally from the 1950s and 60s. There's a visual short-term storage, and we provide the evidence for all this in the book chapter, and attentional control. So if you're really into CAC assessment and cross-battery assessment, you can see that this is not the nomenclature you're used to dealing with, but the theory needs to move on and taxonomy needs to evolve because of the fathers of it would have wanted that. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on those things because I don't, you can look at the slides and study them. Probably the biggest change in CHC started about 2013 or 14 that Joel and I have been talking about is when I was the first one to put the CHC model together. I call it extended GFGC, extended horn GFGC theory in a 1997 chapter. Later became called CHC based on Dr. Woodcock's involvement. And I had to make a decision about how do I integrate Carroll's model with Horn and Cattell's model so I could classify tests for chapter in 1997. And one of the biggest problems was what to do with the GLR because Horn and Carroll had different beliefs about general memory and learning and general retrieval fluency, and Horn had different things. I did my best approximation of what I thought it was, and we came up with this idea of GLR. And there's been marital discord in the family of CHC ever since that was been done. When I presided over that initial marriage of retrieval fluency abilities and some memory abilities. And even though I made some caveats that it was only an initial attempt and a proposed framework, for some reason it stuck. It even stuck in my own writing, which I have to apologize for. It was an attempt to resolve some tensions between the models. It didn't make sense, but GLR was the first attempt to try to reconcile them, but it took, there were problems with it right away from the beginning. And we finally figured out that they needed to be, go through a separation. And in Joel's and my chapter in 2012 in Flanagan's book, we separated GLR into learning efficiency, which is meaningful memory, associative memory and other abilities, and retrieval fluency, which is naming fluency, like RAN tasks, speed of lexical access, ideational fluency. But we kept GLR intact as a union of two discordant, unhappy marital partners. So it was a trial separation. A lot of things happened, and we've explained in our chapter where the data and the support comes. It was very convincing that basically GLR should be GL and GR now. And actually, Carroll was correct. So the new biggest thing in CHC theory is now we talk about GL, which is the level abilities, associative memory, meaningful memory, and those types of things. And it's efficiency in terms of how much cost does it take for a person to learn. And some people need to do more effort than others. So it's not the same thing as cognitive efficiency on the Wechslers or the Woodcock-Johnson in terms of mental processing. It's just how easily does somebody learn and store information. It's putting stuff into the file cabinet of your brain by association or meaningful memory mechanisms and other abilities. We have three listed there right now. Before I go to the GR, another change, or not change, a tweak that's happening to CHC theory is that facets are becoming fashionable. Facets have been around in psychology of intelligence since the 1960s with Humphreys. That basically you can look at, you shouldn't just look at the ability cognitive processing component of a task or a test. You should also look at the content features. Are they manipulating numbers? Are they manipulating visual spatial material? So in some of the domains now, we are adding a facet dimension. And so in GR, and GR is now the fluency with which you can retrieve information. It's getting stuff out of the file cabinet, getting stuff out of your network of knowledge, not putting it in, but just going in and rummaging around in there, finding it and getting it out as quick as you can. And there are three facets to GR. There's this retrieval of ideas, retrieval of words, and retrieval of figures. And you can see the narrow abilities in there. You'll see that some of them are in bold. Joel and I have gone back to Carroll's original work and looked at all the factor loadings and such. Basically, now we are tweaking CHC to say some narrow abilities are more important than others, and we call them major narrow abilities, and some are minor. And so in GR, we have ideational fluency and expressional fluency. speed of lexical access, naming facility, and word fluency. They seem to be the biggest and most important ones in retrieval fluency. There's another major change, or not change, revolution, or not revolution, revision, is that processing speed. We think that there's pretty convincing evidence that there are two major types based upon the facets, that there's cognitive processing speed and academic processing speed. Because you'll see when you do factor analysis and other kind of statistical things like multidimensional scaling and other stuff, that these abilities, the academic things kind of hang together, the cognitive hang together. Eventually they collapse together in one super factor, but we now think there's a distinction there. And we are also proposing, in fact, I'm going to skip this. This is not worth the time. It's I won't get past that. I can come back to it. The biggest change has been probably one of the biggest problems with CHC taxonomy and what test developers like myself do and all the cross-battery stuff is almost every test that was out there, if you use any of what the authors say or the cross-battery type assessment systems, everything's perceptual speed or rate of test taking. If you really know the theory well, it's P or R9. Any practicing school psychologist who gives, you know, the Wechsler processing speed test or the Woodcock-Johnson processing speed test, you'll find discrepancies in those scores, even though they're all classified as P, or perceptual speed. So Joel and I, again, went back to Carroll's original 1993 work, and he talked about a distinction between types of processing speed, and people who've been researching processing speed since the 1950s and 60s have always said there's a substructure under perceptual speed. And Ackerman, who's done a lot of work with adults, found a four-factor structure of perceptual speed. His first two are very similar to what Carroll suggested. So we now think that perceptual speed is really an intermediate stratum level ability. It's between the broad and the narrow. And underneath it, there's also an academic fluency, which is an intermediate stratum. So under academic fluency, we have number facility, reading speed, and writing speed. And under perceptual speed, there seem to be at least two broad categories. Perceptual speed, where you search and scan. Perceptual speed, where you compare and do pattern recognition. So to kind of make this a little more concrete, I just took three different tests here. This is not in the chapter. Yeah, it is in the chapter. So letter pattern matching from the Woodcock-Johnson is now considered perceptual speed searching and scanning. Number pattern matching is considered searching and scanning. Wechsler symbol search would be PS. And then pair cancellation from the Woodcock would be PC, or perceptual speed comparison pattern recognition. Same with Wechsler cancellation and maybe Wechsler coding. So we think that perceptual speed needs to be broken into two types of narrow abilities. And you'll also see that there's a coding after each one about what's the stimulus content. Reading and writing, so letter pattern matching is letters that you read and write. Number pattern matching are numbers, so we put GQ after it. Symbol search is primarily visual spatial symbols. So we think to help understand psychologists better understand why different speeded tests diverge in profiles is that, one, there's a dichotomy between the two different perceptual speed processes, and sometimes it might be related to the facet, the content, or the stimulus characteristics. So I think Flanagan's already working on, or maybe has incorporated this into her cross-battery software. I can't remember. But this is going to require people to kind of recode things and, you know, change their interpretations of some tests and maybe revisit how you look at speed tests when you got a bunch of them. And while we're talking about speed, I'm a big fan of a number of people. Philip Ackerman. He has this theory called the PPIK models, primarily for adolescents and adult. Intelligence is knowledge. So here's one way to think about reorganizing CHC, that there's GC, GKN, which is domain-specific knowledge, reading and writing, and quantitative knowledge. That's intelligence as knowledge, Ackerman calls it, what we sometimes call acquired knowledge systems. That was Cattell's original GC. That it was a super big thing and not what we've now think about as GC. Then there is what Ackerman calls intelligence as process. That's GF, GWM, GV, GA, and GL. And this fits well with Kahneman's work on thinking fast, thinking slow. He's a Nobel Prize winner for his stuff in behavioral economics, but he had a huge book in the last 2 or 3 years ago about thinking fast, thinking slow. These are controlled cognitive operations that require you to do something that's not automatic. You have to control deliberate processing. This is what Cattell originally considered GF. And then there is intelligence as process, but it's the speed fluency component, which relates to Kahneman stuff, which is in the cognitive sciences literature, not so much the psychometric, that there seems to be, GR is a speed or fluency factor, GS is, and so is reaction time. So it's another way to look at organizing the cognitive taxonomy and tests. And there's a pretty consistent evidence that suggests that maybe there's a GS ability comparable to what people consider general intelligence. But the jury is kind of still out on that. I'm only going through the biggest changes. There's a lot of them. GV has been one of the most studied domains in the psychometric models of intelligence. And, here we have the GV domain, and visualization is the most bold. That's the most important GV ability to measure. Spatial relations and imagery. Joel Schneider and I believe is considerable evidence from neurocognitive research, brain network research, and other things that imagery needs to be something we need to be assessing, especially as it relates to creativity and such. But the biggest forthcoming change in the visual spatial domain is that there's a distinction in visual spatial, which was in Carroll's 1993 book. He just didn't elaborate on it, but now the research since then has really made it very clear that there's small scale spatial ability, which is, tasks like block design, spatial relations, the Woodcock-Johnson, manipulating objects where it has an allocentric spatial transformation. And then there's large scale spatial abilities, which is wayfinding, sense of direction, perspective tasting, navigation abilities. And the huge growing literature on large-scale spatial navigation ability is becoming more important in our society because of Google Maps, virtual reality systems, and getting around with GPS and such. There are really no good tests of large-scale spatial ability at this stage, but you're going to be seeing more and more coming in that area. Probably the most important thing is there's some recent meta-analyses that take small-scale spatial ability, which is like what we give in our intelligence test, in large-scale spatial tasks, which are primarily experimental, and the meta-analysis only suggests they correlate by 0.27. What this means is you could be really great at Rubik's Cube, but you might get lost in a new city, even when you have a map, or vice versa. They're not the same type of abilities. And there's a strong neuroscience research that suggests they have different neural substrates. So spatial thinking, in terms of CHC theory, we now need to start looking at tasks and building tasks to take into account the frame of reference. Is it small scale or large scale? And is it also another dimension, which I haven't mentioned, movement. Are they static tasks or dynamic tasks? Dynamic tasks have to do with like looking at things on radar screens, a football being thrown and somebody, tracking it and catching it. Stuff in virtual reality where there's movement of the visual spatial materials. And that's a very active area of research right now. What we've got to think about, there's probably nothing to worry about right now in terms of assessments, but most GV tests we have now are down in this one little quadrant. They're static tasks like block design, block rotation, and they're small scale or allocentric. There's going to be a lot of development going on right now, stuff in more large scale and dynamic visual spatial, especially with today's technology and iPads and such. I'm going to skip that slide. You can read it. Basically, GA abilities have been the Rodney Dangerfield of intelligence for a long time. They never have gotten respect, but the GA abilities are important, just as important as visual spatial abilities as a major component of intelligence. And in GA, we're also adding a facet dimension based upon research by some individuals over in Germany with the Berlin intelligence structure model, that there's speech abilities like phonetic coding or phonological processing, resistance to speech sound discrimination, but then there are also nonverbal GA abilities, which are like sound localization, maintaining and judging rhythm. You're going to be seeing, I predict, a big explosion in some of these nonverbal abilities, especially maintaining and judging rhythm, because we're finding that synchronized clapping to metronomes and such seems to be tapping into a very fundamental, important part of human intelligence and as a potential marker for some early literacy problems and dyslexia. I'm going to skip the Ramsayer stuff there. But I basically just said this, especially researchers at the Auditory Neuroscience Lab in Northwestern are finding that maintaining and judging rhythm is a very good marker test of underlying brain efficiency, especially evoked brainstem response that deals with processing sounds in the in terms of milliseconds. Timings, yeah, so you're going to be seeing more development of auditory temporal processing type tests. So here's kind of the summary of the CHC, where it is now, version, and I call it version 2.5 or something. The big thing is GL and GR have been split. There are the definitions. I'm getting near the end here. What Joel and I have also suggested is that, you know, we're kind of humble. It seems odd that there's these two guys, McGrew and Schneider, who seem to be the caretakers of CHC taxonomy. There are certain reasons why that's happened, and we're somewhat uncomfortable with it. So we've decided that any changes that are made, like the ones I've articulated, all basically we reference back to Carroll's original work and then look at new research. But we also have specified in our chapter that if you're going to be updated in a theory, it can't be just done by one person. And we've developed in our chapter and specified and articulated criteria that should be used maybe by a consortium of people or a committee or a group or something to help nominate new factors and abilities. And I'm not going to go through that. I want you to know that's being put out there because there needs to be more than just two minds working on this. And according to those criteria, there is a new family member in CHC. It meets all the criteria. Some of you will like it, some of you won't like it. It's basically emotional intelligence, GEI. I initially didn't like the idea of it being in there, but and this is the cognitive component of social emotional intelligence that the Mayer Salove Caruso model in particular. There's a sufficient factor research, developmental research, other kind of research that suggests GEI belongs as a cognitive component of the CHC model. It's got emotion perception, emotion knowledge, emotion management, and emotion utilization. And you'll have to read up on that in our chapter when it comes out in April. So what I'd like to do is kind of finish. I've got some contingency slides. So what I've just given you is a quick, very quick overview, and you'll read the chapter when it comes out. I heard it was April something. Joel and I are not really all that interested in arguing my model bifactor versus your model hierarchical, which one's better, and all the statistical debates that seem to go on. We are moving more towards, we want to figure out how CHC abilities work together to help understand human intelligence in school learning. And this is this, I'm going to put all the arrows in because I don't have time here. Joel was nice enough to put my name on this at the last minute, but he's working with a doctoral student analyzing data from the major test batteries and norm data and coming up with structural causal models. That's not so GS causes working memory then goes to GF, which then goes to GC. And you can see there's different linkages that there's a dynamic, maybe causal system here and not just a simple hierarchical factor model thing. And actually, Joel and his Matta are the ones really doing the work. So to kind of end before, here's what we typically look at for a CHC taxonomy. The top line are the major abilities. The other ones are tentative abilities that are in the thing model, such as olfactory, kinesthetic, psychomotor. And what Joel and I are moving for and think we need to be spending more time is rearranging these taxonomies to make sense of how they might work together. And this is one we had in our 2012 chapter. We organized CHC ability by motor, perceptual processing, controlled attentional abilities, acquired knowledge, and still the functional idea of long-term storage. Here's another one that we presented in that chapter, but we didn't talk about it as much. It's another functional organization where you organize CHC abilities by sensory domain specific in a functional group or a conceptual group. This is one of another way of looking at CHC. It's the Ackerman framework that there's intelligence as knowledge, intelligence as process, intelligence as process, speed, and fluency, and then physical competencies. And then that there might be a GS ability above it. And this is my favorite one coming up, is an information processing model. And this is one Joel and I have been working on for a while. It's conceptual. It's not supposed to be, you know, the perfect model. That CHC abilities should be organized as those that are tied to sensory perceptual systems, those that are acquired knowledge that are up in your own personal cloud or storage cloud, GL, which is putting stuff in your cloud, GR is pulling stuff out, and then working memory and fluid intelligence is the bottleneck of everything. And so this is a dynamic causal model. And as you see, there's no G in these models because we think, G is a statistical artifact. That's for another time. And we're working on these kind of models right here. So with that, the rest of my slides are contingency slides. And I'm going to kick out of them and open up for questions.
All right. Sounds good. I know that we've had a couple questions come in. I'm going to jump in with one, and then after, let's see what we can get to. So a viewer wanted to know, where does attention and executive functioning fit into CHC?
Okay. Do you want me to get my thing off so you can see me?
Sure. Or whatever works.
Oh, now you're seeing the screen of my TV. Oh.
You can click on the little...
there I am. Okay. Where do executive functions fit in?
Yeah, attention and executive functioning.
Like okay, I've got a whole module sitting here on the side if we wanted to really get into that. Joel and I talk about this in our chapter because there's been some really good research done, especially over by Steve Bowden and his student Dewsbury over in Australia at Melbourne University. It's kind of like mini Carroll analyses of massive data sets. And what they have found is that in terms of psychometrics, executive functions does not come out as a separate distinct factor that cannot be explained beyond what's in the CHC taxonomy already. What the thinking is and what I think it is, executive functioning is a bunch of different neurological functions in different brain areas of the brain that, you know, some of them are active during GF, some of them are active during GV, some of them are active during another task. And they collectively kind of, when the synchronization of them is kind of executive functions, but they're not a psychometric trait per se. They're different parts in different brain networks that kind of go on and off like a modem. You know, like you see your modem flashing, and sometimes certain things are being, you know, and so executive functions is kind of the coordinated synchronization and turning things on and off of these inhibitions, switching and updating kind of things. And so it's not a psychometric trait per se. It's more of a neurocognitive emergent property kind of trait. So it's not a CHC type ability. So it's something different. That's my thinking. And same with attentional control. Attentional control, if you look at the brain network research, I got a ton of slides on this. There's like 7 to 10 brain networks that we're finding in the contemporary brain network research. And there's 3 that are really critical. There's one called the central executive network, which is primarily the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe, connected by a white matter tract called the arcuate fasciculus. That's the PFIT model of intelligence. And then you've got the default brain network, which is mind wandering, where you kind of think about things spontaneously. And then you have what's called the salience network, which is the air traffic control system between the two of them. So when you need to do really focused problem solving, the salience network, which is certain parts of the brain working together, shuts down your brain, your mind wandering, task unrelated thoughts, so you can focus and do problem solving with the central executive network. When you're in a more creative mode or something, Salience Network will put you back to the default mode, and so you can start pulling stuff out of your knowledge and such. So control, the attentional control is really the switching back and forth. How good can you turn that off, and how good can you do it? And it relates to different networks of the brain working together, like what I call the modem model.
This is so cool and interesting. Another viewer said, this is incredibly fascinating. What are his thoughts on tests catching up with the changes in theory?
What I thought about it?
Yeah, what are your thoughts about the tests catching up with the changes in theory, up to the changes in theory?
Oh, it's going to take a while. It's going to take a while. The whole process of developing tests, it's a commercial enterprise. You know, there's publishers. There's a business model behind it. And if you notice, you know, some of my best friends work at Pearson. The Wexlers took a long time to get to CHD. They're there now, basically, with the five. It's basically, I mean, I say it right out front, but they didn't want to make them a lot of changes that would cause too much consternation amongst the users that would cause sales problems. So I think that the changes are going to be slow, primarily because of the constraints of the business model. There's a lot of really good stuff going on by people who are doing just peer research. I think we're not far away from some innovative psychometric test development stuff because of the technology and what you can do with an iPad and the computational stuff you can do under the hood on your desktop or your laptop computer. There's really some potential that within maybe 10 years, we're going to see some things. Joel and I talk about a lot of ideas for that kind of stuff in there. I don't think you're going to see anything too soon, though. Not in the next 5 years or so.
Yeah, I when you were talking about the GV and the broader, because I'm thinking of, you know, like you mentioned, Google Maps, and I myself, I say that I'm like spatially challenged. I cannot find my way around anywhere. But yeah, and the iPads immediately sprung into my mind that kind of opens up the door for a lot of new and interesting and different tests, I feel, kind of computer game-ish, rather than maybe what we typically have.
Oh yeah. There are people developing tests, game type tests, and then correlating with psychometric measures that are out there. But these are people who aren't developing tests for commercial purposes. They're researchers. I think, you know, I think Pearson was the first one through the wall on iPad administrations, and the first one through the wall always gets bloodied. So I think they took a lot of heat for it, but I think I admire them for doing that. I think every next generation of an intelligence test is going to be on some kind of a computer platform, probably still have a hands-on version too, which opens up to me some really exciting potential ideas in terms of test development and also in terms of how you score the tests. And for example, am I still have time?
Sure.
Okay, no. I don't know how many of you have ever given the retrieval fluency test in the Woodcock-Johnson. Name all the colors you can, or all the animals you can think of in a minute. Mm-hmm. Bang, 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 bang. You know, tell me all the blah. You remember the categories? You can in a minute. You got three probes. Now, I've seen psycholinguistic people who have taken that kind of information, recorded all the responses, and they use the latent semantic analysis and tools from what's called network science, and they build this network map. It's a very squiggly kind of thing. It looks like a three-dimensional fishing net, and you can see where certain nodes are very powerful and a lot of connections coming in and how tightly certain ideas cluster together, and then there's another one over here, another one here. If the technology is there, I think that if we could capture people's responses when they do those type of tests, and also vocabulary tests, anything verbal, and the test publishers, when they norm their tests, and I have this on my mental list for the next time we do it, to capture all those responses, and then you could develop and say, here's the model for an 8-year-old, what it looks like, that the normative model, three-dimensional, of how vocabulary is organized or idea production is organized, and you could take a person's responses, put them in, and you could get some quotients, or like a retrieval quotient. How good, you know, did the person's retrieval compared to the normative group? how deep is their network of knowledge or ideas? Is it a very sparse network? Is it, how is it organized? So I think that's kind of exciting to me that we may be able to get more into what's really going on and how we process information, even with existing tests, the technologies there. I'm always way ahead thinking about what we should be doing.
Wow. We have some other great questions here, and some of them are kind of similar, so maybe I'll ask two together. Eric asks, are tests often attempt to separate factors? Do you have any thoughts about tests connecting with the interconnectedness of the model you showed? And then another question is, you know, some scholars have claimed that several CHC-inspired tests are over-factored. Do you have a thought about that?
Yeah. That's kind of what I got into earlier about the debate that's going on. Yeah. It's the bifactor people versus the hierarchical model people. And I'll just put up one slide here. Oh, maybe I already did it. I already put it up there. Let me see here if I can find something quickly. You're seeing my directory structure, right? Let me see here.
No, not yet.
You'll be seeing something shortly. I don't know if this is going to answer the question, but it's what I'm going to do. You got something there?
No. Did you click on the green screen share button to the left?
Oh, yeah. Maybe I should just verbally say what I want to say. Okay, screen share. Oops. Paraphrase the question again.
Okay, so one question was about the tests connecting the interconnectedness of the models that you show, those mm-hmm. dots moving all over. And then the other one is, at what point do you think, if we're trying to measure these small components, are we over-factored?
Okay, I was trying to get a nice PowerPoint that I'm working on to respond to this kind of stuff. You've got a car engine, right? There's an ignition system, there's an electronic system, there's the fuel injection system, there's all these different systems, right?
Right.
Now, what's the quality of how you usually judge an engine? What's one of the metrics?
The run.
Horsepower. Horsepower, okay? I have some slides that really show this with animation and such. Can you see horsepower in the engine? Is there a horsepower piece in there?
Right, no.
No, there's no horsepower piece. But horsepower is what comes out of these things all working together. And that's called an emergent property. Mm-hmm. And in factor analysis, and God, I wish I could put my slides up there, but you're going to see my creativity here. This is G. And these are the little arrows coming down from G to the four different factors. Five, I can get my thumb in there, okay? That's called the classic model of intelligence of how people are doing factor analysis.
Right.
That G is causing the stuff down here. You go like this, it's called G is actually just an emergent property of the brain, like horsepower is. There's not a thing in the brain that is G. It might be neural efficiency or brain networks working together. It might be an indicator of how good a brain is working, just like horsepower is. And if you go to this kind of model, and there's an article by Kovacs and Conway about 2-3 years ago, which what they call it process overlap theory model. If this model is right, this falls apart, this whole thing about your overfactoring. Because mm-hmm. when you have anything that's interconnected and correlated, you get positive manifold, and G is a statistical mathematical necessity. And where some of this is coming from is in the field of pathology. People have been proposing a P. This is a general pathology trait. And some psychometricians, especially over in the Netherlands, who are really bright people, are saying, wait, don't do the same thing in psychopathology that the people in intelligence did wrong. That it's and do this, that there's a something in your brain that causes all, you know, schizophrenia, psychosis, manic depression, and that kind of stuff, that maybe this statistical thing we think we have as factor is just an emergent property of the brain, and there is no G. So when people are arguing, saying, hey, you're over-factoring tests, you have to buy into the fact that there's a G. And I have a lot more I could say about that. It's got some good readings on it, but I don't think we're over-factoring, especially when you get away. There's now a thing called network psychometrics. It gets into how measures relate in like three-dimensional space, and it's more of a network model, network analyses.
Okay.
I'm probably going to get myself in trouble, but I was an early factor analysis crazy person too. I believed that everything that came out of factor analysis was the truth. And I've learned since then, especially when I worked with John, Jack McArdle, who was John Horne's mathematician and factors guru, one of the best in the country. He said to me, Kevin, factor analysis is only one tool. It's only one lens to look at things. You got to look at neurocognitive evidence. You got to look at behavioral genetic evidence. You got to look at, you know, how things correlate with things, and look at the brain structure stuff. Factor analysis is a limited tool. And I think a lot of people in academic school psychology are, this gets me into a lot of trouble, are guilty of the law of the instrument. You give a child a hammer, everything's a nail. Okay, that's all I'm going to say.
We've got some really good questions. I'm going to read you the next one. Alberto asks, was there any evidence for the existence of orthographic processing abilities, perhaps under GVGS or alphanumeric GRNA? I was wondering if GA is being underassessed. There seems to be a focus on phonetic. Oh, wait, is this two questions? I'm sorry.
Yes, sorry.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, oh, they're together. Sorry.
I'm going to show my ignorance, just my lack of knowledge. I don't know what orthographic processing is. And I keep asking Nancy Mather, the co-author of the Woodcock Johnson, has got a test of it out there. It doesn't isolate as a factor. Okay. But it doesn't mean that it isn't a process. It's kind of like in my mind, it's kind of like executive functions. It's a bunch of different abilities maybe working together as an amalgam. It's not a factor. Factor models are all about, you know, you got all these things down here, and this is a clear factor. Here's a clear factor. When I talk about amalgams, it's like going across. It's a number of different abilities working together in concert. And so I don't know if it's a clear psychometric trait like GF and GV. I think it's more of an amalgam of things working together, and that's why it doesn't show up in studies as a factor. Just same thing with executive functions. It's more of a functional thing that different parts of the brain or different things are going together to work together like a modem. So
interesting. I know I hear a lot of talk online and stuff about orthographic processing, and I don't really know so much about it.
I think I have a deficit in it. You ever seen my spelling and my handwriting? It's atrocious.
Okay, so I'm gonna read the next question that I accidentally started reading before. Robert asks, I was wondering if GA is being underassessed. There seems to be a focus on phonetic coding. Should we be supplementing with tests such as the scan?
Yes. Phonetic coding, GA is being way underassessed. First of all, Gustafson and colleagues have shown that things that are under phonetic coding are actually, there's a lot of different abilities that differ based on terms of complexity of processing underneath there. There's some that are simple phonetic coding and they're more complex phonetic coding. But the abilities that are being really underassessed are temporal processing of sound wave information in terms of milliseconds. And, you know, we didn't have the technology there before. But that's the work I was alluding to about GAs underassessed. There's just been an explosion of research in the last 10, 15 years about the importance of processing sounds at the millisecond level. And there are tests that can be developed that are, you know, today, especially today's technology. And Nina Kraus at the Auditory Neuroscience Lab at Northwestern, which would be a good webpage to go to, is correlating psychometric measures with these more millisecond measure things. And that's where this maintaining and judging rhythm, where they're having kids, you know, do stuff to metronomes and measuring their millisecond performance as an assessment tool. I know it's also a therapy tool, and they're coming up with some extremely interesting findings that, which to me suggests the next version of intelligence tests need to have some more measures of temporal processing in terms of milliseconds, because it can be easily done with today's technology, maintaining and judging rhythm, and there might be some others. But yes, GA is being very underassessed. In some respects, I think GA is more important to human intelligence than GV. There's an article out there, I can't remember who wrote it, in Trends in Cognitive Science, talks about auditory abilities are the scaffolding upon which language is built. And language is what is used for thinking, is the tool for thought. So it's called the auditory scaffolding hypothesis. We don't measure our auditory well because we didn't have the technology to do it back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. But now we do. So yes, it's underassessed.
I've got a question, and I'm going to probably show my lack of knowledge here, but because I worked in a cross battery district about 3 years ago, so I'm a bit rusty now. But I know that then, and I only worked there for 1 year, so I have kind of a limited understanding. But a lot of my colleagues would kind of downplay GV, that it wasn't super important because, according to them, it didn't necessarily correlate as well as some of the other areas to academics. But the way that you're talking about GV sounds like you feel like it's pretty important. So can you clarify GV for me?
Yeah, well, Barb Wendling and I wrote an article in Psychology in the Schools in 2010. It was a special issue on CHC. And we had a section called the GV Mystery. And because when we reviewed all the studies that were available based on CHC theory, and we couldn't find strong relations between current psychometric tests of GV and anything. But there's an extremely diverse body of research outside of psychometric testing where they do some stuff with other kind of three-dimensional kind of processing that shows that visual spatial abilities are extremely important, especially for the STEM, science, technology, education, and mathematics. We know what is. It's the ability to do visual thought experiments in your head. The problem is our tests that we have in our current intelligence batteries just don't seem to tap into it well. So GV is very important. There's a National Academy of Science publication that came out sometime in the last 10 years you can get for free that talks about visual spatial intelligence and visual spatial thinking and why it's more important in our society than ever. Problem is we on the Woodcock-Johnson, on the Wechslers and all the other tests, we don't do a very good job of measuring the stuff that people are doing in their heads. With virtual reality coming, I think the assessments are possible. With computers, I think we can start doing stuff where people are manipulating and moving things, and there's dynamic moving things and perspective taking and stuff. So I think GV is important. We just haven't been able to measure it well yet in applied intelligence tests.
Gotcha.
Very, very important.
Okay, I have one last question, and I'm going to try to articulate it so it makes sense, but I find it so fascinating when you talked about the horsepower and the model. I think I can do it too.
I got some really nice slides on this.
Yeah. So if horsepower is the process, and then the factors are the parts of the engine, and personality in Ackerman's theory would be maybe one of those factors, correct? Because personality is like knowledge versus process. Is that right?
Yes, Ackerman's PPPIK is personality.
Personality.
Intelligence is process, intelligence is interest, and knowledge, or something like that. Yes, and I've got a series of slides here that I wish I could put up.
I'm just wondering what you think about personality measurement. And
yes.
Really good right now, probably, but should school psychologists look at that more, at temperament and personality and of our students?
Not so much personality. There's Richard Snow's work on cognitive abilities, probably the most important, underappreciated work in school psychology, one of the most brilliant educational psychologists around. And he talks about cognitive abilities. And in there, you've got motivational beliefs, which has to do with intrinsic motivation, locus of control, those kind of things, self-beliefs, self-efficacy. I have some great slides on this somewhere. And and there's volitional controls, which have to do with self-regulated learning. It's kind of not personality per se, but it's more cognitive thinking dispositions. How you get engaged in tasks. I think school psychologists should be doing a lot more in there. If you go to my webpage called the Mind Hub and look under, I can't remember what the category is, but I have a thing called the MACM, the Model of Academic Competence and Motivation, where I tried to take all the research on personality and cognitive non-IQ abilities and come up with a conceptual model of what things we should be maybe assessing on kids beyond intelligence. And yes, we should. The problem is there aren't any very good tools out there.
I love that. That's so interesting. I love the emotional intelligence pieces that you're looking at. I think that's so interesting. In the future, in learning more about all of that, seems hopeful and bright.
Yeah, there was a... Oh, never mind. I can just talk forever.
And we are running out of time. We really appreciate you joining us tonight and sharing all that information with us. And the PowerPoints really blew our minds. Thank you so much. So we're gonna wrap up. Thanks to, I think we had a good chunk of viewers out there tonight. So thanks everyone for tuning in tonight. Join us again on April 15th for ADHD Essentials. Thank you, Dr. McGrew. It was great meeting you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. Thank you. Night, everybody.